Today, migration, replacement, and statistical BS. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analysis, one that is post covering finance and property news. Last week in my show with Tarek Brooker, we discussed the stash about the ABS, migration, and arrival statistics. Recall that recent data on arrivals versus departures showed a significant uptick in potential population growth. The Australian government's official document, Fundamentals of Migration in Australia, Migration Concepts and Measurements, from the Centre for Population, has explicitly stated that border crossings data are more timely than other migration flow data releases, meaning that they can be used as a potential leading indicator for net overseas migration. The same document also states explicitly that border crossings, that's arrivals and departures, are an early indicator of future migration flows. Now, last week, the ABS contacted a number of media organisations, including Macro Business and the Daily Mail, claiming that it had inaccurately and misleadingly used the monthly net permanent and long-term arrivals data as a, quote, measurement of migration. In fact, Radio 2GB was also fact-checked for using this same data. Ben Fordham highlighted that 279,000 arrivals in 6 months, and went on to say that this was plane loads of new people coming into the country. He didn't refer to them as net permanent and long-term arrival statistics, by the way, which perhaps that's what he should have done. Now, in my own coverage of the data, I was at pains to point out the difference between the two data sets, by the way. But the trajectory is pretty clear, more migration, not less. Now, 2GB host Ben Fordham probably shouldn't have opened with "the latest migration data is out," and instead said something like "the latest data on net permanent and long-term arrivals into Australia is out." But frankly, this is a very small beer issue. The fact remains that the net permanent and long-term arrivals figures was the highest for the 6 months of any year in Australia's history. Daniel Wild, the Deputy Executive Director of the Institute of Public Affairs, responded to the ABS's apparent attempt to censor the migration debate. "It seems highly unusual that the ABS would publish data and then complain when it's used to uncover what is going on in Australia," he said. "It appears that the ABS has been sent out by the Treasurer to shut down debate about the federal government's failed, unpopular mass migration program. While net permanent and long-term arrivals and net overseas migration differ slightly, they remain closely related measures. They have been an accurate statistical guide which has uncovered Australia's unplanned migration crisis. It would be highly inappropriate for sections of the ABS to be running cover for the federal government to try and divert attention away from Australia's out-of-control migration system. The ABS needs to think very carefully about making itself a political target. The ABS can either stick to its role as an independent statistical agency, or it will blow its credibility by politicising itself. There is no place for such political interference from any organisation that must be seen at all times as strictly impartial." I agree with that. Now, the reality is that for years, economists have used the monthly net permanent and long-term arrivals data as a leading indicator of migration. Now, the ABS received support from the ABC's Media Watch last Monday, which attacked so-called right-wing media outlets for raising alarm at the astronomical number of net migrants landing in Australia, which of course are higher than anything Australia has experienced before the pandemic. But actually, the Media Watch segment never really debunked Radio 2GB's claim that a record around 280,000 arrivals had landed in Australia over the first half of 2025. Radio 2GB never used the term net overseas migration in its disputed segment, which is effectively the net permanent and long-term arrivals figure adjusted for the 12 over 16 month rule. For net overseas migration purposes, an individual must have lived in Australia for 12 out of 16 months to qualify as a migrant. Now, remarkably, an ABC program actually dealing with immigration statistics is pretty rare. But instead of acknowledging that Australia's immigration and population growth rates are excessively high by first world standards, or the huge economic and social costs that Judith Sloan, Alan Kohler, and other economists, including friend of DFA Leith von Anselen, have been describing, Media Watch instead focused on data minutiae, trying to paint opposition to historically high rates of immigration as xenophobic and racist. In fact, ABC columnist Alan Kohler wrote, on the same day, at least 800,000 more people came to live in Australia over the past 4 years than Treasury anticipated. That's more than three extra Hobarts. The fact remains that when the pandemic ended, the Australian government had no idea that net immigration would total 1.6 million over the next 4 years, and apparently had no way of controlling it, Kohler wrote. The failure to match population with housing and infrastructure has led to a more serious decline in living standards than evident from GDP per capita statistics. There was no acknowledgement on the Media Watch piece that the extra 800,000 people that have inundated Australia have caused rental vacancy rates to plummet and driven asking rents through the roof and, of course, house prices up as well. Now, this measurement is not perfect, but it has historically correlated very strongly with the official quarterly net overseas migration data, which is at least 6 months delayed. Actually, the only migration expert that they turned to was Peter MacDonald, who offered that often heard reassurance that we should not worry too much about current historic immigration levels because they are, quote, expected to fall. Actually, in Australia, the RBA and the government does seem to be actively censoring any reference to immigration, even from their modelling, which trashes their forecasting capability, by the way. Throughout her time as Australia's Home Affairs Minister, Claire O'Neill boasted that Australia was in a race for global talent with other advanced nations like Canada, and O'Neill argued that immigration had been the, quote, special source of a national story and advocated for more. And she stated that Australia needed to transition away from a system which is almost entirely focused on how we keep people out to one that recognises that we are in a global war for talent. Now, it's here worth comparing the US Department of State, who recently ordered the suspension of all new applications for international student visas, and the Australian government approach, which has increased the 2026 planning level for international students by a further 25,000 places per year to 295,000. The government also, by the way, relaxed English language requirements for visa holders seeking entry to Australia. Universities Australia proclaimed that the nation's higher education institutions are willing to enrol academic refugees who are barred from other countries. Australia's universities are open to the world, Universities Australia Chief Executive Luke Sheehy stated. If any students are displaced by policy decisions overseas, Australian universities stand ready to support those affected. Education Minister Jason Clare added that we welcome genuine international students who want to study here. We have some of the best universities in the world. International education is a valuable national asset to Australia. It doesn't just make us money, it makes us friends, he said. Chief lobbyist Phil Honeywood, the CEO of the International Education Association Australia, likewise declared that the sector is ready to take other countries' scraps. Australia has been very fortunate that other countries we compete with, particularly Canada, Donald Trump's USA now, and the UK, are also winding back on international student recruitment, he said. And therefore, when students are thinking which country to go and study at, they're obviously seeing that Australia is, in many cases, the least worse when it comes to their ability to access education. And the most recent IDP Emerging Futures survey showed that Australia remains the top study destination for potential overseas students. Now, I've argued for some time the idea of a larger Australia is one attractive to the Treasury as it expands the GDP, if not GDP per capita, despite the rising pressure on infrastructure and housing. But if you want to understand the real reason for stoking migration, you need to go back to an IMF report titled Replacement Migration. Is it a solution to declining and aging populations? It was first published in the year 2000 and revisited in 2020. The report argues that population decline is inevitable without migration. Most developed countries will shrink and age rapidly due to low fertility and increased longevity. For a country's population to remain stable over time, they say, discounting any impact from migration, the total fertility rate needs to be about 2.1. But it's a lot lower than that now in most Western countries, despite the global population rising from about 5 billion in the 1980s to 8 billion now, with strong growth in Africa and other global South countries. So as a result, the so-called support ratios will collapse in Western countries like Australia, as the working population per retiree will halve in many countries, threatening pension and healthcare systems. And they go on to say that migration, though, is not a panacea, because even high levels of immigration cannot fully reverse aging trends, but they say they can mitigate economic and fiscal impacts. And they actually modelled some country-specific scenarios. The report modelled alternative migration levels for places like France, Germany, Italy, Japan, South Korea, Russia, the UK and the US. And in passing, by the way, we should note that birth rates are declining significantly, with recent data from the UK showing that the fertility rate for England and Wales has fallen for the third year in a row to reach a record low figure. The total fertility rate across both countries, meaning the average number of live children women can expect to have across their childbearing life, stood at 1.41 in 2024, down from 1.42 in 2023. That's the lowest since comparable data was first collated back in 1938. Internationally, the UK is following the same trajectory as most wealthy countries. Fertility peaks at lower levels of development, then decline as education, prosperity, and women's autonomy rises. Unless childcare, housing, and long-term stability are addressed, you can expect the fertility rate to remain low or even fall further rather than bounce back. All this means that governments must include a policy about strategic migration planning. Governments must treat migration as a long-term demographic tool, not just a short-term labour fix. Policy should align with workforce needs, integration capacity, and regional development goals. And they argue that replacement migration can ease fiscal pressure, but ageing societies still require structural reforms in retirement age, healthcare delivery, and productivity. And they say governments must clearly distinguish between legitimate demographic planning and conspiratorial narratives. Transparency and data-driven messaging are essential to maintain public trust. And here we need to highlight the so-called Great Replacement Theory, which was coined by French author Renard Camus in his 2011 book, Le Grand Replacement. It posits that white European populations are being deliberately replaced by non-European, particularly Muslim immigrants, through mass migration and declining birth rates. Now, while the theory itself is not a legitimate policy framework, its spread has influenced political discussion and discourse significantly. Far-right parties have used the theories to justify restrictive immigration policies, often framing migration as an existential threat to the national identity. Examples include Hungary's Viktor Orban, and also in Italy too, where demographic fears have been invoked to support anti-migration stances. In North Africa, governments like Libya and Tunisia have echoed replacement rhetoric to justify cracking down on NGOs and migrants. Libya expelled 10 international NGOs in 2025, accusing them of demographic sabotage. This rhetoric, of course, undermines humanitarian neutrality and turns race and origin into political determinants of aid. And meanwhile, in the US, figures like Tucker Carlson and former Trump officials have echoed replacement narratives linking immigration to electoral manipulation, and has led to increased xenophobia and policy proposals aimed at curbing legal immigration and birthright citizenship. The theory actually has become a cornerstone of white nationalists and identitarian movements across Europe and North America, and it's inspired multiple acts of terrorism from New Zealand to the US. And it's been stoked by online platforms and memes. On the left of politics, the theory of replacement hasn't been endorsed, but it has become effectively an intersection with demographic concerns and critiques of neoliberalism and global capitalism. Some leftist thinkers argue that elite-driven migration policies serve economic interests by creating a precarious labour force, though this critique is rooted in perhaps class analysis, not ethno-nationalism. The far left generally rejects the radical framing of the theory and instead focuses on solidarity, anti-racism and migrant rights. But all up, it misrepresents demographic trends and relies on racial essentialism. Population changes are complex and influenced by fertility rates, economic migration and integration, not conspiratorial intent. In fact, despite its lack of empirical validity, though, replacement theory has gained traction. A 2023 UK poll found that 32% of respondents believed it was probably or definitely true. And its persistence reflects broader anxieties about identity globalism and political disenfranchisement. However, its influence on political discourse, migration policy, and public sentiment is undeniable. Governments, of course, must navigate the tension between legitimate demographic planning and the toxic narratives that exploit those concerns. For policymakers, the challenge lies in addressing migration with nuance, balancing economic needs, humanitarian obligations, and social cohesion without succumbing to conspiratorial rhetoric. Replacement migration is not a silver bullet, but it's a critical lever for demographic and fiscal stability. Maybe. The real challenge lies in aligning migration policy with housing, infrastructure, and regional development strategies. It's a delicate balance, sustaining economic growth while preserving social cohesion and affordability. But, and this is the critical point, closing down debate, detuning statistics, and pushing policy which is frankly fragmented won't help anyone. But that seems to be where we are. So let's have a mature debate about the real impact of migration, about how we get the economy right-sized in terms of housing and other infrastructure, roads, healthcare, all of those things. Because without it, we're going to end up in a very bad place. And those pushing ideological arguments, specifically those perhaps wanting to create mayhem from a political sense, will capitalize from this vague and unacceptable position. And yet, the local situation in Australia is that the government is, on one hand, saying, yes, 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 we want to see migration come down, but on the other hand, is clearly pushing migration really, really hard. And then claiming that the statistics aren't telling the truth in any case, which is not a good look. And politically, it's pretty bankrupt. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.